All right. Well, it's a pleasure to have Oliver Philcox here to give us our cosmology seminar this week. Thank you, Oliver. Just to say that we're trying to do something where the seminars are more interactive than an ordinary seminar, hopefully to make the remote seminars a little bit more engaging. We found that the more people ask questions, the better they work. So let me just encourage everyone to chime in and ask and yeah, don't worry if that happens, Oliver. Anyway, so take it away.
Okay, sure. Let's share my screen. Cool. That everyone can see that? Good. Okay, cool. Well, first of all, thank you very much for coming. It's a pleasure to be here in, well, there in Canada from grey and miserable England. Okay, so what I wanted to do today is talk about a couple of different things I've been interested in the last year or two, all generally pertaining to the idea of the effective field theory of logical structure. So I want to start by giving a kind of more pedagogical overview of the theory itself, before then talking about three specific applications that I've come to find are very interesting. They kind of go beyond what's normally kind of thought of as what you do with perturbation theory. So to start off with, I should kind of begin by thanking my collaborators, in particular, the top row of David Spergel Extended, especially Eleanor Massara here and Paco in Princeton, and then the East Coast Effective Field Theory Group, which is Matthias Zadariaga and collaborators. So most of the work's been done in collaboration with some or all of these people. Okay, so to begin with, I think the first question that's really important to ask is, what exactly is effective field theory? And before I go into depth with this, what I want to say is that my aim is to present more of a heuristic overview with the aim of you being able to understand what the motivation and main principles are without being super rigorous. So for anyone in the audience who is familiar with the complete rigor of it, don't be alarmed if I'm slightly hand-wavy at things. That's sort of my intention. But yeah, the idea is to give you a broad understanding of why we do it and how it works. So to start off with then, let's go back to graduate cosmology classes and start with perturbation theory. So the idea of perturbation theory in cosmology is that it describes the evolution of structure on quasi-linear scales. So beyond the scales which are got by the linear power spectrum, but not quite onto non-linear scales, which are when we've got gas drift that's happening. So in general, we have two observables, a density field, which is normally written as this overdensity in terms of some mean density, and a velocity field. So these are the standard ones we characterize most of physical observables with somehow. So in order to think about how to model these, the standard trick is to start off by writing down the fluid equations. So as you're probably familiar from any kind of hydrodynamics experience, fluids are described by the continuity equation, the Euler equation, and the Poisson equation, the conservation of mass, conservation of momentum, and gravitational fields. Now these equations are relatively straightforward. They're mostly linear, but not quite. Got a couple of non-linear terms in here, which make everything significantly more complicated. And if we assume that our matter is pressureless and a Newtonian fluid, we can assume that these equations hold and use them in order to develop our perturbation theory. And a bit later on, I'll come back to the idea of whether these fluid equations are actually valid. Okay, so taking these equations, the easiest way to solve them is simply to go into Fourier space. So if I take equations one and two, go into Fourier space, schematically, I have equations that are looking something more like this. So the idea of these is you've got a time derivative of the density field plus some function of velocity, they're written as a divergence. And they're related to the standard density field and velocity field just by some convolutions. So the exact kernels and alpha and beta kernels aren't particularly important here, but the idea is we can write everything simply as some convolutions in Fourier space. So now what we want to do is take these equations and solve them. If we were interested purely in linear evolution, it's a relatively simple thing to do. So the linear order solutions for the density and for the velocity divergence are simply proportional to the linear density field. So this would be the density field you'd get at redshift, kind of, well, high redshifts, times by some scale independent growth factor. So I've got standard one D here, and some contributions from the velocity terms also in the velocity. These can be simply obtained. So the linear order solutions are simple. Everything's perfectly linear, straightforward, and a linear power spectrum is just going to be a rescaling of our initial power spectrum. So that's all easy. The complexity, however, is when we get to the next level. So how, when we go to the beyond linear solutions. So the idea is we want to expand perturbatively, assuming that our first order solution is relatively small. So as with any perturbative expansion, we take a first order piece, and then a second order piece, and a third order piece, and we hope that every successive term we add is going to be smaller than the previous one. So here, I've actually separated out the time and the spatial parts. We've got some nice growth factors D multiplying by a purely spatial part. There is some caveats here. This is technically only true in a specific Einstein de Sitter universe, but that's an assumption which we can neglect here, and in fact can be neglected pretty safely in most of cosmological analyses, or standard ones at least. So I've made this ansatz. I've said our density field can be written as some perturbative sum of smaller and smaller pieces, but obviously this is just an ansatz. It's worth thinking about what these actually are. So the standard prescription then is to say that nth order density field is some convolution of n powers of the linear density field. So the second order solution is simply first order piece squared. Well, first order piece convolved with itself with a kernel. The third order solution is three powers of the linear density field, etc. So you can see each successive solution builds up higher and higher powers of the linear density field. Now, at this point, we haven't actually used F-load equations properly. If you were to go back and insert this solution and work everything through, you would find out some relations for our coupling kernels, which basically set the theory. So that's all good. So I'm not going to go through the mathematics of that because it's not particularly inspiring, but I can tell you it can be done. But once we have these, what we can do next is we can compute the matter power spectrum. So I'm sure you're all familiar. Power spectrum is simply just square of the Fourier space density field. And in this standard perturbation theory context, we can write it as a linear term plus two one loop terms. Now, what I mean by one loop is that when we write them out explicitly, they have one integral over momentum. So effectively one loop if you were to do these diagrammatically. Now, in general, the one loop terms contain integrals over two lots of the linear power spectrum. If we were to go to the next order, the two loop terms contain integrals over three lots of the linear power spectrum, etc. So at this first order, we just have two of them. Great. And this is kind of a general principle. As I say, we can extend up to higher loops. The calculation has been done up to three loops for matter. And we could go for higher order statistics, like bispectra, trispectra, pentaspectra, whatever else. So that's the status of perturbation theory, the standard perturbation theory, which has been done for, well, over two decades now. But Bernardot is kind of the canonical reference for it. However, it has some problems. And I want to briefly mention these problems because it leads into why we're interested in having an effective field theory. First of all, there's a question of what are we actually expanding in? So I've said everything's a Taylor expansion. It's a Taylor expansion in density. And the density, as we know, is large on small scales because we have things like halos and galaxies. So in fact, it's not certain whether our series is actually convergent. Number two, is the matter actually a perfect fluid? We assumed it was to make our fluid equations, but that's not certain either. Number three is that the integrals I was writing down, kind of stuff like this, the sort of integrals over momentum, it's not actually sure if these properly converge. The integrals themselves could be divergent, and that's not great if you want a nice well-behaved theory. Number four is possibly the most important one. Biggest problem with standard perturbation theory is that it doesn't really work. It doesn't converge to the truth. So I've got a plot of this. So at this point, what I want you to focus on is the black dots, which are the results from simulations of the matter power spectrum, normalized by some linear power spectrum. And then this red dashed curve up here is the result of one loop perturbation theory. You can see it's quite a gross overestimate on pretty much all scales, even down to pretty large scales. If we go to the second order and add the two loop terms, though now combinations of three lots of the power spectra, we grossly underpredict the power spectra. So this is really indicating that things are not converging, and that's not a really particularly good way to have a theory. So what do we do? So the solution to this, well, there's been many different perturbation theories described to try and get around this. The one which is probably the most successful in Fourier space is so-called the effective field theory of large-scale structure, which is what I'm primarily talking about here. So we start off by thinking about a little bit about scale dependence. So it's kind of shown in this infographic here. Conventional perturbation theory, when we do it, we're tacitly assuming that it works on all scales. So when we do, for example, when we do integrals over momentum, we're integrating all the way up to K of infinity. However, we know that our perturbation theory doesn't work at K of infinity. So really what we should be doing is restricting our theory only to scales that we know can be treated perturbatively. So here, we're restricting our scales to k-modes below some lambda. And this is kind of an essential part of effective field theory. Now, I say this is exactly the same as effective field theory in, for example, particle physics, which explicitly cuts off at some energy scale. We're doing the same thing here, except we use momenta rather than energies. Now, the idea is that using symmetry, we can do this cut, and we know what the corrections are going to look like. So on large scales, cutting off at this value of lambda is going to give us corrections to our standard perturbation theory, but we know what the form of these corrections are. And in general, these corrections are going to be some k-dependent functions with free parameters. And the free parameters can be fit from simulations. And it's not just they can be fit, it's in fact they should be fit. They should be fit from our kind of full, complete theory of the universe, which is a simulation, or the universe itself. So that's kind of a broad brush overview of what we're doing. Let's see how this actually works in practice. Again, kind of taking a more hand-wavy approach.
Could I interrupt for a second, Oliver?
Good, yeah.
So those two cutoff scales on the previous page,
yes.
The K nonlinear and lambda,
yes.
Where would those lie on the figure you showed previously showing the discrepancies between the different?
Yeah, sure. So obviously the nonlinear scale depends quite strongly on redshift. So I think these results are at redshift zero. So I think the nonlinear scale is around kind of 0.3, 0.4. I think at K of zero.
Okay.
So it's towards the right-hand edge of this figure.
Uh-huh.
Now, the cutoff scale is, it's worth saying the cutoff scale isn't actually fixed. And something I will come back to in a minute is to say that the theory really shouldn't depend on exactly where this cutoff is. It should be relatively large. It should kind of be the limits of where our theory can be described. But it really doesn't make sense if our theory depends on that cutoff. So it's safe to say it's kind of beyond the right-hand edge of this figure. But
okay, thank you.
Super, super tiny scales. Yeah. Okay, thank you. Great. So then in order to do this effective field theory in practice, what we do is we start from exactly the same field equations I wrote down before, but we smooth them. And we smooth them because we say that we can't expect to describe physics beyond this scale lambda. So let's smooth that input equations such that we don't have to do this. So we simply apply just a nice Gaussian smoothing, top hat smoothing, whatever you fancy, and we get almost the same equations. The only difference is this extra term here on the right, which can be written as an effective stress tensor. Now, if you're familiar with hydrodynamics equations, this stress tensor is completely usual. It comes from non-ideal fluids. This can encapsulate a whole range of effects, like density gradients, viscosities, sound speeds, all sorts of things. So it's actually a term we expect. And had we right at the beginning said we want to use the non-ideal fluid equations, we'd have had a term like this. The other thing is that we actually know what this term should look like in terms of kind of sound speeds, viscosities, etc. So that's good. So the other thing this does is it gives us a well-defined expansion parameter. So I said before, we had problems doing our Taylor expansions because our density becomes large on small scales. However, we're now using a smooth density, which is guaranteed to be small everywhere because we've done this smoothing. Okay.
That's all.
Yes, sorry. Of course.
So is the form of this stress tensor, you know, assumed to have like a certain, you know, like a certain form, I guess. I mean, you know, so normally, right? So we would, you know, write down fluid equations, you know, by taking moments of the Boltzmann equation, right? Yep. You know, so your stress tensor, you know, similarly would be some dynamical, you know, quantity with its own equations of motion.
Yeah.
But that's not being done here, right?
Yeah, no, not explicitly here.
You know, so like, so my question, I guess, is, you know, what assumptions, I guess, are being made about the form of this stress tensor?
Okay. So I think one thing that's normally done is we write down the stress tensor in terms of everything that will be in a normal fluid equation. However, I think another important thing is that we actually get extra contributions to this tensor from the smoothing operations itself. For example, if you smooth the product of two fields, that's not actually equal to the product of the smoothed fields, those correction terms. And those correction terms have a nice well-defined form, which go into this stress tensor. I think the important, in fact, really for kind of one loop effect field theory, all we need to know is the leading behavior of the stress tensor, which we do understand. So I can say that much.
Okay.
That makes sense. Okay, cool. Great. So effectively, so skipping a load of mathematics, what happens when we do this is we get the same density field from solving these equations, but we have an extra term. This extra term has a quite nicely defined form. It's simply k squared times the density field times by some sound speed. So this is exactly the same form had you allowed to have a sound speed in your fluid equations. So this is what it would look like. In case we call it the effective sound speed. And it incorporates small-scale physics. That's important. And it must be fit from data. Simply plugging this through, we could similarly get equations for the power spectra, simply just taking the excitation of the squared field. So what we notice is we get exactly the same solution. The only difference being is we get an extra one-loop counter term on the end. It just goes as k squared times by the linear power spectrum. So it's deceptively simple. We've simply added one extra term. We're going to see that, in fact, this is very useful.
Okay, so like you know, so it looks then like you're assuming that the stress tensor is isotropic.
At leading order, I think. So this is important to say. We're only using the leading order contribution of the stress tensor.
I see. Okay, and so you can show that the anisotropic parts are, you know, are higher order.
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Great.
So could you just say that's at leading order? You mean not in the do you mean in the perturbation expansion or in leading order?
We're doing everything kind of in leading order of in terms of the long in leading order at k, so valid at small low k or large scales.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah. So. Okay. Good. So there's one little subtlety actually here. So in this formalism, when we compute our loop integrals, we should only compute them up to some fixed value of the cutoff. And now, so we're effectively doing the integrals, but only up to lambda rather than up to infinity. That's a well-known thing. A well-known kind of part of effective field theory is that your theory shouldn't depend on where you do the cut between small and large scales, or low and high energies, equivalently. Because physically your theory shouldn't depend on some kind of man-made cut that we've introduced in order to understand the theory. But it looks here that our theory does explicitly depend on this. In fact, a very nice property of this is if you look at it, you can actually show that the dependence of the cutoff goes exactly as k squared times the power spectrum. The reason this is important is because it can be exactly absorbed into this speed of sound counter term that I previously mentioned. So this is really another way to think of what this counter term is doing, is it's explicitly removing any dependence we have on the large scales, or on the kind of high K, high energy parts of the theory. And this is, again, a generic feature of effective field theories, is that it should be independent of our cutoff scale, and we need these kind of counter terms in order to make sure that happens. make sure we don't have dependence on the kind of high K so-called ultraviolet modes. Okay, so then let's see how this actually works in practice. We take the same theory and we simply add on this one extra counter term at one loop. And we do is we go from this red dashed line to the red line. Now, whilst at high K it still doesn't look particularly good, you can see at low K, we're actually getting much better agreement. So up to kind of K of 0.1 here, we get good agreement. If we were to go up to two loop accuracy, to add in another swathe of terms and more counter terms, we get very good agreement here up to about K of 0.25 or so. So it's certainly true this theory is able to give you a good indication of the matter power spectrum. Okay. However, the matter power spectrum isn't all we have in cosmology. So the other thing that we generally need is bias traces, so halos and galaxies. So how do we deal with these? So one approach which has been used is to take the galaxy overdensity and expand it perturbatively in powers of the matter overdensity. To say it's matter overdensity plus the thing squared, the thing cubed, etc. So that'd be one way to do this. This is how a lot of standard analyses have worked in the distant, well, not too distant past. However, this does neglect some things. So do we have dependence of the galaxy overdensity on other things? For example, it could depend on tidal fields. It also is going to depend, it also is going to have some dependence on time. This isn't actually, any kind of galaxy bias isn't likely to be local in time. It's likely to depend on all the previous history up to this point. We've also got things like gradients popping in. We've also got stochastic terms. For example, when we think about halos, we often assume that halos are produced randomly with some Poisson distribution. So if that happens, then we're going to need an extra term in this expansion to account for this stochasticity. So why I'm saying this is to say that the galaxy overdensity is actually quite a complicated beast. So in the EFT approach, what we do is we first of all write down every possible operator which could come into the galaxy overdensity and associate every one a free parameter and then combine them. So for example here, this is the galaxy density at third order in density field. So we've written down every possible combination of operators which could contribute to the galaxy density at third order and associated each one a bias. So for example, the density ones I showed before, additional ones with tidal fields from the other second derivatives of the potential, the stochasticity, this one's a gradient operator, etc. We've all got some implicit time integration as well.
So Oliver?
Yes.
So can you clarify what you mean by operator as opposed to just like some field?
Absolutely. Okay, so by operator, I mean any observable which we can create from fields in the universe. So for example, the gravitational field itself isn't an observable because we can never observe the field, we can only observe its second derivatives, but any combination of the second derivatives is an observable. And that's what I mean by an operator here, if that makes sense.
Yeah, in other words, it's borrowed from the QFT language. It's not because it's actually operating on anything here.
Yes, that's true, yeah. Observable field would be another way to say it, yeah. Okay. So the key point of this is that each one of these things can be expressed in terms of the linear density field or some stochasticity, and they're all generically going to lead to new terms in the power spectrum, and often new counter terms, because we have to be careful again that we don't have these dependence of super high K modes. But you notice our theory is getting longer and longer and more complicated. Of course, there's another thing we haven't considered, which is redshift space. So redshift space and real space are simply related. Redshift space is simply real space plus some line of sight projected velocity. Straightforward. It's relatively straightforward to include this in the theory. First of all, we say that our density in redshift space and our density in real space must be equal. Well, when we have volume elements as well, that's simply because halos have to be conserved. This is just a physical change of coordinates. When we do this, we're going to get extra terms involving the velocity now. So for example, at lowest order, we have the galaxy density and a velocity field. Now, I should also say this velocity field is just the velocity field of matter. It doesn't need to be the velocity field of galaxies, simply because by the equivalence principle, it's guaranteed that galaxies and galaxies and matter must have the same velocity on large scales, which is where our theory is residing. Great. So now to give a tiny summary of what I've just been saying, what we can do is we can say that a galaxy density field is equal to first order piece, second order piece, and third order piece, plus contributions from these counter terms, which is needed to ensure we have the correct treatment of high energies or small scales, and some stochasticity from random halo positioning. In general, all of these can be written as convolutions with some kernels, and the kernels get more and more and more complicated. So for example, these are the true ones up to third order. And if you were to go, for example, up to a two-loop theory, they get longer still. Anyhow, we have developed this theory. So the real question now then is, what do we do with it? So for quite a while with effective field theory papers, simply wrote down the theory and showed that it fitted the data. So something that's been a very interesting new development is actually the application of EFT to data, and specifically galaxy survey data. This is something that's been done kind of primarily by two teams of people, one so-called the East Coast Cosmology team, and one the West Coast team, headed by Matias Aldriaga and Leonardo Sinatori. And that's focused on basically applying this full expansion here to a galaxy power spectrum. So I'd like to spend a couple of words talking about that. So one thing that's been in recent analysis seen a lot of galaxy surveys doing is to take all their cosmological information simply from the position of the BEO wiggles and also the ratio of the monopole and quadrupole, so P2 over P0. So this encodes the angular dependence and also gives some additional information. So this really measures only about three numbers. And there is an underlying question of, is there more information in power spectrum? And is there information in the actual shape of it, the full shape, rather than just a position of some wiggles? So we're now in a position where we have an accurate and rigorous model with which we can probe this. Just to remind you, a model is linear terms, one loop terms, counter terms, and stochastic terms. All of these contributions are particularly important.
Like, but this model can be said to be, rigorous.
Yeah.
You're making the claim that it's a complete description of possible measured power spectra,
yep,
only because you're ignoring possible selection effects on the observed power spectra, right?
So, yeah, I mean, the hope is that most of the selection effects can be absorbed within 12 bias parameters. So all of these kind of contributions, like I said, the galaxy density is a bias times the linear density at lowest order. The idea is that most of those selection effects would go into that. Obviously, also we have window function effects as well, which we properly include.
My understanding was that the reason why the full shape hasn't really been used so much in the past, is I think the observers weren't really confident about their ability to measure the full shape, robustly to these effects.
So what I will say now is that certainly quite a number of tests have been performed with the pipeline over the last couple of years. So there's a lot of tests on mock galaxies. And from a theory point of view, not from the observations, this has been tested with simulations about the size of the entire observational universe and proved that it can recover unbiased cosmology. I can't comment too much about the observational side of it, because I'm not a particular expert in that. But I'll say certainly from the tests that have been performed, it has been accurate.
And so you're saying people have putting in various forms of, biases from window functions and things, but the CFT was able to, successfully recover the
absolutely. And with something like window functions, I would say we don't quite use this formula quite as it is here. We properly convolve in window functions and stuff like that. And there's been quite a few papers on the effects, for example, from fiber collisions and other experimental things like that. So a lot of things have been developed in the last couple of years about this.
Okay, great.
Okay. So a data for this is conventionally the data from BOSS, for the 12th data release, which is all completely public. It has a volume of around 2 gigaparsecs, effectively, split across two redshifts. And it really comes in two forms. And the first form, which would be these kind of top lines, so the red and the blue lines here, so what we call the pre-reconstructed power spectra. So this is the power spectra you basically just get from measuring your density field and computing a power spectrum. And the other one is what I've labeled as the post-reconstructed spectra. So in this spectra, what we do is you measure the density field, and then you effectively try and move your galaxies from their current positions to their positions earlier in their evolution. So basically trying to move them from where they are now to where they are, say, at redshift 90, or not, so a high redshift. The idea of this is that galaxies have moved between, say, redshift 100 and redshift now. And that moving actually tends to dampen and smooth this kind of wiggly behavior that you can kind of see in the spectrum. Actually, as you see, comparing the yellow and the red curves, so the yellow one has significantly stronger BAO wiggles than the red ones. And this is because we've been able to partially undo some of this galaxy large-scale displacements in order to sharpen the effects. Primarily, however, focusing on the pre-reconstructed ones for reasons I'll mention in a minute. So generally, we have a relatively simple pipeline.
Could I ask a quick question about the last slide?
Yeah.
So in some of these curves, for example, in the bottom left-hand plot, comparing the red line to the points, it seems like the points are systematically lower. And in some of these, it seems like there's a systematic amplitude offset or an overall tilt or something. Is that concerning, or statistically, does it seem fine?
So I think statistically, yes, this is fine. I'd say also the bottom patches are very small volume. So most of the constraining power actually comes from the upper two plots, which are much larger volumes. So yeah, I think the chi-squares for the data are roughly consistent with what we'd expect.
Okay, thanks.
Why is the low Z higher volume?
Sorry, I don't think I was quick. That was slightly incorrect. The Southern Galactic collapse and small ones. Low Z and high Z, yeah, actually low Z is slightly... Low Z is a smaller volume, but a larger effective volume, I think. Something like that. I'd have to get back to you on the exact volumes of those, actually. Not entirely sure.
And so these are best fit curves shown against the data points, is that right?
I believe so, yeah. I think so.
So what's stopping the high G, what's stopping the high Z NGC fits from going through the data points?
That is a very good question. I am not entirely sure. This right on the spot.
This is like a free parameter, right?
Yeah. So, okay. Well, I would certainly be happy to check with my collaborator who made this plot and get back to you about it.
Yeah. All of these things are fit simultaneously. All four curves.
Yeah, simultaneous fit. Yeah.
Okay, so it could be that, right? It's just an individual curve, they're pulled one way, but overall, they're the best curve.
Yeah, no, that's true,
The low Z and high Z biases are different, presumably, right?
Yeah, we do assume different biases,
So then similarly for the southern and northern?
All four have different biases, yeah.
Is that physical to give different biases to the northern and southern?
So at some level, you would think possibly not. However, there's also the thing that these probably have different observational effects. So for example, they will have slightly different selection functions and things like that in reality. So that's basically why we allowed the biases to be different.
Yeah, that was one of the things I mean to ask, which is that the observations, the data in the northern and southern gaps, I think have a discrepancy, right?
Yeah, that is true. Actually, there is a known one in BOSS.
It's the same selection function. It's just the calibration. You can't north-south calibration because there's no linking between the two in data.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Sorry, it's Andrei here. Can I just make a comment? Because I just had a look at the paper, and I think the colored lines are the means and the scatter from the mocks.
Absolutely, sorry.
So they are not best fit, so I guess that can ameliorate them.
That perfectly solves that. I apologize completely. Yes. Okay, yeah, so that solves that problem there. In fact, that means some plots. I should probably have read that. Okay, so that's a slight discrepancy between the mocks and the data. Okay. Well,
wait, sorry. Yeah. The box are these boss mocks, you mean? So your EFT stuff hasn't been used anywhere in this plot?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. That's true. The EFT has not been used in this plot.
Okay. All right, yeah, sorry.
Okay. So now what we can do is take this data set and basically combine it model in MCMC and use that to get some constraints on cosmological parameters. Now, I say this has a couple of kind of good features. One is that it's all public domain. It works with any modifications you want to make to class can necessarily be included in this formalism, with the caveat that you will have to think carefully if they include extra perturbative terms. If they don't, it's simple. It's been tested on kind of things beyond Lambda CDM, for example, early dark energy. It's also actually super fast. So at the beginning, there was quite a worry that it would be significantly slower than doing simple analysis of BO. And in fact, it's actually very, very quick to perform these days, which means it's not a significant speed detriment compared to kind of the standard analyses just using the BO. Okay, so given this, what we can do then is get constraints on cosmological parameters. So I see here it gives competitive constraints on cosmology. You can see that the constraints in blue in the EFT analysis are of a similar order to Planck in certain variables. One of the things that's actually very useful is that generically, a lot of the parameters have different degeneracy directions, which means we can combine them with the CMB to get much stronger constraints than either thing can have on its own. However, one thing I will note is that these constraints aren't particularly much stronger than the constraints we would just have got from the BEO itself. Now, two factors go into this. Number one is that we don't use information from the BEO. We don't use all the information from the BEO, which I'll get back to. Number two is that BOSS is still quite a small volume survey, so the errors are still pretty big. We will expect greater improvements when we go into larger volumes. It's been a lot of forecasts doing things for like Euclid. Okay, so go back to this idea of BEO reconstruction. So as I said before, what happens kind of between the universe at redshift 100 and now is that the matter undergoes large wavelength displacements, which tend to move the particles and damp out the BEO effects. So you can see this in the correlation function. In fact, what we actually see is kind of a dash blue curve like this. And in fact, I think the black curve in this figure is the same correlation function at redshift 99. So the idea of this reconstruction is to undo that displacement to get back a sharper BAO peak. So you can see here is a sharper peak in the correlation function. In general, this has much sharper BAO features, which is good. However, the broadband shape is actually much more complicated to model. And it actually can depend on quite a few systematics, like how you did the reconstruction itself. So if we wanted to apply a kind of full shape methodology to this, it's actually very difficult. And at this point, a full effective field theory has not been worked out for the reconstructed power spectrum. So we're thinking about how we could add in this information. So we're actually kind of proposing a joint analysis, which is the first thing you do is to measure the BEO position from the reconstructed power spectrum, but just the position, nothing else. And then find the covariance of this position with the unreconstructed spectra themselves. So this covariance is power spectrum cross BEO position. And then run the standard effective field theory analysis on this combined data vector of power spectrum plus the BEO position. So this is robust. It's been tested on quite a lot of mock catalogs and stuff like that.
Sorry, can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
I'm kind of confused why BEO is not already included in the EFT analysis.
Okay. Yeah, so I think to clarify that, I should say we do the analysis for the unreconstructed power spectra. So they have some signatures of the BAO. However, it is possible to get stronger signatures of the BAO if you do this reconstruction. So not all of the BAO information that we could include has been previously included. So these things will have a non.
Isn't the point of EFT that you don't have to do the reconstruction? You have a model of nonlinear, or maybe you're talking about the higher order correlation function.
Yeah, absolutely. So when we do this, so part of the point of reconstruction is that it takes higher order statistics and puts them back into the power spectra. So for example, the reconstructed power spectra include bispectrum contributions, which we wouldn't normally be able to capture if we just looked at the power spectrum.
Grand. So we can then run this analysis in a similar way, and we can get new constraints on cosmology. You can see there are not a huge deal of Griffins, but importantly, actually for H naught, we get some fair amount of improvement. So if I zoom in on that, you can see, in fact, that our H naught constraint goes from about plus or minus 1.5 to plus or minus 1.1. Now, the idea of this is that the BEO parameters, the degeneracy direction of that is such that it measures H naught pretty well. So that's actually what's giving us the extra information here. And I would just say of this result, it's quite nice because we get a measurement of H naught, which does not take any information from Planck. The only kind of information it takes at super early universes, apart from the theory model, is we have a prior on Omega Baryon from Big Bang nuclear synthesis, because galaxy surveys on their own are not particularly strong at constraining Omega Baryon. Okay, so that's kind of a nice result. So the question then is, what more can be done? Of course, other effective field theory type analyses are possible. We could use the bispectrum, we could use the one-loop bispectrum, two-loop power spectra, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So combining the power spectra and bispectra has been shown to have somewhat of an improvement. So we go from the orange to the blue constraints here. So this is just on a simplified analysis, just showing the constraints on the amplitude and the neutrino mass in this example. There is still the outstanding question of, if we do our analysis involving the power spectrum and this reconstructed power spectrum, is that good enough that we don't need to worry about doing things like the bispectrum? And that's still an outstanding question that hasn't yet been addressed, and something that certainly will be interesting to look into. Okay, so that's all stuff with galaxy surveys. I think at this point, I'd like to kind of briefly mention two other interesting things that can be done with effective field theory. Now, these things are certainly somewhat more preliminary and are not yet at the stage of application to data, but certainly are quite interesting possibilities for future exploration. So number one is this idea of alternative density field statistics. So generally, we do analyses with the density field of galaxies. The question is, do we have to do it with galaxy over density? Could we be thinking of some other statistic which is actually more useful? And the reason for this is that we know that low density regions of the universe can actually carry a lot of cosmological information. For example, there's been a lot of recent papers which show that cosmic voids carry a lot of information. And the idea of these is that they're low density regions, we can treat them with linear evolution, they're not virialized. In general, they don't contribute much to the density field, simply because the density field at late times has a lot of regions with very large densities, which are generally going to kind of flatten over the regions with smaller densities. So a couple of alternative statistics have been proposed over the years. The interesting one of these, which we're interested in with Eleanor here in Canada, was the Mach density field. So the basic idea of this is that, firstly I'll say this has specific use, in particular constraining cosmology, the most notable being the neutrino mass. So this was just done from some numerical Fisher forecasts that showed that for matter in real space, we could constrain the neutrino mass with power spectrum to a level in this dotted line, or with the marked power spectrum from this marked density field to a significantly stronger level. And I'll get back in a minute to why we think we can do that. So this marked density field business, what it really is it's a standard density field, but with a weighting. And the weighting is a local overdensity weighting. Basically what it does is it takes the low density regions and it upweights them, and it's gonna downweight the high density regions. So you can see this in this map here. It's be the standard density field in the top panel. You go down to the marked density field, the lowest density regions of the figure become a lot more apparent. And the idea is it's gonna give a lot more weight to them, so we're going to need to get more constraining power from information hidden within these voids and other low density regions. So a question I got interested in was, can we treat this perturbatively?
So sorry, can I ask a question? Why was delta R in the denominator there?
Sure. So delta R would be in the denominator here simply in order to downweight the high density regions, which would have larger delta.
Delta S is a constant?
Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean that yet. Yeah, delta S is just some constant.
Okay,
I think delta R is a smooth density field.
Okay, sorry, yeah. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so taking this kind of mark and this mark density field, we're interested in how we can treat this perturbatively. So in order to do this, what we simply do is write out the mark density field and simply do a Taylor expansion. So the interesting thing about this is it's a Taylor expansion involving the normal density field and the smooth density field and successive powers of this. So this is obviously a different structure what you see in the usual power spectrum. And I should note at this point, all this analysis specifically for the matter density field in real space. I can briefly mention bias traces in a minute. So once we've done this expansion, we can then do a very similar perturbative thing to what we do for the standard effective field theory and create some perturbative solution order by order with a linear part, second order part, third order part, and some counterterm part, as we know we need from effective field theory. And each order can be written down as some powers of the linear density field, just as we do for the standard power spectrum, with some coupling kernels. Now, really, it's these coupling kernels which are going to change, and they're going to make changing those is going to change the full structure of the theory. But say, in fact, each order now depends on both the density field and its smooth version. However, the smooth version can be written just as a filter times the field in Fourier space. So that's why it's kind of dropped out this expression here. Okay. Once we pull all this through, a couple of pages of algebra will show us that mark power spectrum at one loop order, again, first non-trivial order, has just a linear theory component, so one loop component plus some counterterms. It has the relatively nice feature that all of the extra terms just involve the smooth density field, which decays at high k scales because we've done an explicit density field smoothing. So they're nicely well behaved, which is quite useful. So what does this look like? So what I'm showing on the right here is a plot of this mark density field as a function of scale, which are these black dots here, and comparing it to linear theory and the effective field theory predictions in green with the standard perturbation theory in blue, which is the same as the effective field theory, just without the counterterm structure. And this is at redshift 1. You notice actually the theory is relatively well behaved here. It works relatively well. We can see we get relatively good agreement of effective field theory. However, it's quite interesting. Linear theory fails on all scales. This is not something you're used to seeing in the standard power spectrum, when on large scales, linear theory works, and as you get to smaller scales, linear theory gets worse, when we need one loop terms, et cetera, et cetera. So we have the interesting feature, really, is that we have big contributions from the one loop terms at large scales, which is why this linear theory and the EFT don't agree at large scales. If we were to go down to a bit lower theory, redshift, what we'd find is the theory gets worse. And really, this is likely because we really need to expand up to probably the next perturbative order to get this theory to work at lower redshifts. We can also get around this by actually smoothing the theory slightly better. We'll get much better agreement. But this is certainly an interesting idea of the theory, that we get such different behavior of linear theory at large scales. So what we were really thinking about with developing this perturbative model is, can we use it to understand why the marked power spectrum is useful? So as I said earlier, the marked power spectrum was shown to have a huge tranche of cosmological information in it, but we didn't really understand why and where this was coming from. What you can see in the right panel here, in the dashed lines, I show the power spectrum. And in the full lines, I'm showing the marked power spectrum with all at one loop order, but allowing for different amounts of non-linearity to creep in. So in the red curves, I'm just showing effects of linear theory. In the blue curves, I add non-linearities into the density field. And in the green, I add non-linearities into the density field and the smooth density field. And it's really all of these components are very necessary in order to get a theory which well approximates the truth at large scales. So first thing, note that the mark suppresses the linear terms in large scales. And this is actually explicitly the form of the mark specifically kills a lot of the linear terms, which means on these large scales, you've got a lot more influence from your nonlinear terms. That kind of led us to this conclusion that in the marked power spectrum, small scales and large scales are explicitly coupled, and they're coupled through nonlinear effects and gravitational non-Gaussian effects. So one way to think about this would be to say that you have contributions from, say, your bispectrum and your trispectrum, all of which are folded into your large scale behavior, as well as kind of other contributions from your small scale physics. So this really tells us why it's actually good at constraining cosmology, it's good because all the information we generally find at small scales, which is actually super hard to recover, is now being shifted into large scales. So for example, neutrino mass generally has an important impact in the small scale power spectrum, but by shifting it up into larger scales, we're able to recover a lot of that extra information. Same with power spectrum slope NS. So the question then would be, what's next for this? So we've shown that it can work for real space matter and simulations, but can we go further? Could we actually think about, could this be a tool that we could one day apply to data? So we would of course have to think about things like bias traces. So here's kind of a very preliminary plot with that. In the bottom, I'm showing the results from matter. In the top, from some halos, and again, n-body simulation. This is only using, in fact, the most basic bias model. So it's just assuming linear bias. We don't include all the other higher order effective field theory terms that should properly be included. But the preliminary results look promising for this. And this is certainly something could be that should be explored more in the future. Still, there's two major questions. Number one is, does the theory still have this impressive constraining power on cosmology for galaxies rather than matter field? And that's still somewhat of an open question, something that we're interested in looking into. And the other, possibly slightly more virulent thing is, do we couple in baryonic effects? So I said that we've got this transfer of information from small scales up to large scales. However, what does that do? Is that also going to bring in baryons? And if it does, that's something we need to be worried about and actually have to start modeling very carefully. So that's just a little introduction to this. And it's something that sort of in the future, we're hoping will be able to be applied kind of more generally and see if we can actually get these really impressive constraints on cosmology in real data.
What are the dashed and dotted lines and why did they switch?
Absolutely.
Matter?
Okay, so the dashed and dotted lines here are for the linear and one loop terms, respectively. So the matter, it's the linear, is the dotted. And the EFT is the dashed lines. For the bias traces, so I think they're switching, it's to do with how they're being fit. So I think these are fit to about K of 0.1 or 0.2. And I think the dotted lines are unable to get this fit to work, basically, in general, with the free fitting parameters, which for the matter field is simply just the single counter term we have. For the bias tracer field, we also have a linear bias and also a short noise. So it's really a breakdown of that fit on the larger scales.
Okay.
So there's one other thing I want to very briefly give a little flavor of, just to say it's another exciting application that potentially could be used for effective field theory. And this is only take a minute. I'll do. And this would be, can we do effective field theory for weak lensing? This is something that most weak lensing analyses generally focus around kind of numerical models of power spectra, like halo fit approximations like that. And it would certainly be interesting to see if we could have an analytical approximation or analytical approach for it. So I'd start off by saying the weak lensing spectra in general can be written as some integral over the matter power spectrum. So it's a redshift space integral times by the power spectrum. This is assuming the Limber approximation, which is valid on not the larger scales, but quite a large range of scales. And it's the whole redshift dependence of this is just some function that can be modeled. So one could say then, could we compute the weak lensing spectra just simply by integrating the matter power spectrum? And would we be able to get an effective field theory for weak lensing simply by doing that? It turns out it's not quite that simple. In general, CLs get contributions from a very broad range of scales. This kernel is pretty broad. So we actually need a model for the power spectrum that works beyond just sort of the quasi-linear scales. I would like to point out there's some interesting work, actually Simon Forman has been doing a couple of years ago about the effect, just the pure effective field theory predictions at a wide range of redshifts for this purpose. However, what I wanted to highlight here is actually a slightly different approach. And it's basically saying, could we combine this effective field theory I've been talking about with a semi-empirical model for the power spectra on small scales? So the idea would be, on large scales, we use effective field theory, which we know works. And on small scales, we use the halo model, which we know kind of approximately works. And would this enable us to get an accurate model for the lensing power spectra? So to simply say, in the usual halo model, power spectrum is some integrals over Halo stuff, so Halo profiles, Halo number counts, etc., times by linear power spectrum. Split into these two regimes, the two Halo one, which is contributions from between different Halos, so those are kind of our standard contributions, the one Halo terms, which depend on the contributions within a Halo. So these are the small scale regime. So that's the standard Halo model. So then the paper, David Parker and I spent 43 pages saying, let's take that model and simply add in the effective field theory and just smooth it. And we have a lot of discussion about why we do this. And you can kind of derive it from a lot more of a physical level than simply just plopping this assumption in. Kind of in the context of the Halo model, if you make certain different assumptions, this comes about naturally. But the question is, does this work? It's very simple ansatz. And what I'm showing here is the results on the left of this power spectrum. So in black are the results from simulations of the power spectrum. And in blue is the conventional Halo model, which you can see isn't really a super good fit. Works kind of well on large scales and super small scales, much smaller than the curve plotted up to here. But in red is our new effective Halo model. One thing you note here, it's actually it's an excellent agreement. So this has two free parameters, one to do with smoothing, another to do with this counter term. It's deceptively simple to write down. And in fact, in the right, I'm showing a plot of the ratio. And you can see it's actually percent level consistent. Other simulations will show it's percent level consistent up to K of one in a whole variety of different cosmologies. So it seems then we've got a semi-empirical model, which at large scales is going to encapsulate all our relevant and physical stuff by being based on the effective field theory. But on small scales also is applicable because it's based on the Halo model.
Power spectrum, matter power spectrum?
Yes, this is perfectly the matter power spectrum, simply.
Isn't an effective, the EFT power spectrum supposed to be the matter power spectrum? I don't understand what is the Halo model doing here.
Okay, absolutely. So what I would say is if we had simply plotted the effective field theory on here, we would again get good agreement. However, it would start, a one loop effective field theory, it would start to break down kind of, at percent level, it starts to break down actually very early, kind of around K 0.2 or so, and it hugely diverges off by larger K. So there's no way we'd be able to fit to the much broader range of scales, because effective field theory is explicitly only for large quasi-linear scales.
But it seems that then all you're doing is you're just smoothing the AFT prediction at large Ks, and then you add a one Halo term to it.
Effectively, that is. Okay. That's effectively what we're proposing. So again, this actually comes out quite naturally if you use the standard Halo model language and assume, in fact, that your positions of galaxies depends on the smooth version of the EFT density field, the nonlinear density field.
But this is not about the galaxies. This is just the matter itself.
Absolutely. However, when you create this in a Halo model, you in fact start off by thinking about the halos, and then you integrate all of them over all of them because you say that all matter is in halos in some level.
Okay, so I guess the other question I had is that one of the problems with the matter field from Halo model is that you get unphysical result at very small k's because the one Halo term dominates.
Yeah.
You still have that problem here?
So in this paper when it went out, we did still have that problem. It wasn't particularly obvious for these simulations because they're relatively small. So actually, we were talking to Fabian Schmidt about a way to get around this. So he has kind of an approach based far more on the effective field theory side of things, which effectively says that the one Halo term arises from the stochastic part of the effective field theory, which is a natural contribution to it. Mm-hmm. And basically through kind of another semi-analytic approach, basically interpolates from it being zero at ultra large scales to the one Halo term at ultra large scales. In fact, so since then we've redeveloped this model a little bit, and now we can get it fitting extremely well all down to kind of K of 10 to the minus 4 or so.
Okay.
So yeah, we do have prescriptions to get around that.
Are the blue and red being fit here? And if yes, how many parameters are going into each of these?
Okay, so the blue is not being fit because the Halo model, the standard implementation of the Halo model does not have free parameters. The red is, it has two free parameters. One controlling smoothing, effectively you could think of the cutoff between the two Halo and one Halo, and one controlling the counter term necessary for effective field theory.
Okay.
So I will say this is, it's not simply working at a single redshift. It works at redshift 0, 1, 2, 3, etc. And we tested, I think, for about 1,000 different cosmologies, and you can always get this percent level agreement. So it's robust in general. Mm-hmm. So just to come on to my final slide, what I want to say is another feature of this, is in fact, we can predict the covariances between the power spectrum and also halo number counts. So this is an interesting statistic, mostly because if you were interested in, for example, doing a combined analysis of the power of weak lensing and thermal Sinyar-Zeldovich effects, the TSC requires number counts, and weak lensing requires the power spectrum, so it would be an important underlying statistic for that. So in the right-hand plot, I'm plotting this. So the points here are the numerical results, and the dashed lines are standard halo model, no free parameters. The curves are the effective halo model. So whilst this does have two free parameters, these free parameters are fit from the power spectrum, so there's no additional fitting to get this plot at all. So in kind of these extended statistics, it's also doing very well using exactly the same model with a couple of extra kind of considerations to think about. So the interesting application we're thinking about doing for this is to use them to compute projected spectra. So to see, could we use this formalism to compute weak lensing? And the hope is that since we can get a good model for the matter power spectrum, it will enable us to be able to write down a good, accurate, and theoretically motivated spectrum for weak lensing, including including one loop effects as well. So kind of at that point, I'd like to kind of sum up, say effective field theory is accurate, useful, allows for parameter inference. It's not simply limited to alternative density statistics. It's not simply limited to the density field. We can do other density statistics, such as the Mach power spectrum. And additionally, there's this possibility that maybe by combining with semi-analytic models, we might be able to get also theoretical predictions for projected statistics like weak lensing. Yeah, so thank you very much, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Hi, Oliver. Good to see you. Can I ask you about the free parameters in the theory? So how much of an understanding do we have how they depend on cosmology and astrophysics?
So that's a very good question. So we did actually, in the paper, spend a while trying to see how this dependence results. I'm kind of trying to do a fit of the free parameters to important cosmological bits. So the redshift dependence is relatively well understood. I think it comes in mostly through sigma 8. In general, we would advocate for fitting the parameters specifically to the data set in question, as kind of with any effective field theory analysis. It's always the case that they should be refit. Simply because we don't know the specific realization of underlying small scale physics. And because they depend strongly on the small scale effects, it's really the small scale effects feeding back onto the large scales. And if those are changing, we should allow the parameters to be refit. However, we have a vague idea of, we have somewhat of an idea of how they depend on cosmology, which is quite useful for setting priors on those parameters. So a constrained fitting for them is generally something we would advocate for.
And to what extent, sorry, there's road work outside my home, so I apologize if it's loud. But to what extent do the extra, you know, what are essentially noise parameters, to what extent can they be used for actually performing cosmological tests or giving further discriminatory information, or to what extent are they just needed to get reliable answers for the usual parameters?
I think certainly at this point in cosmology, in cosmological analysis, it's certainly the case that they're always treated as free parameters, which are used to get out the actual information within power spectrum effects. I think that's something that's potentially would be an interesting thing to be seen in the future, actually these parameters influencing cosmology themselves. However, of course, if they're depending on very small scale behavior, it's actually very difficult to model, very difficult to understand. So at this point, I think I think it's certainly the case that they're always treated as nuisance parameters, but perhaps in the future that could actually change.
Okay, thanks.
Sorry if you already answered this question maybe at some point during the talk, but early on you did mention that you had a cutoff scale with a K that was smaller than lambda, and that this cutoff scale in theory in the universe at least physically wouldn't exist. So can this effective field theory, or at least the power spectrum that you included in the paper, be extrapolated to model more fine structures? So like K beyond 1.0, as you've shown in the graphs, if you go to like K equals to 10 or something.
Okay, so I would say that the effective field theory itself, just in its pure form, I think generally cannot be extended kind of into the nonlinear regime, simply because it's built as a perturbative expansion, and beyond kind of the nonlinear scale, the density field itself is large, so Taylor expansions just do not apply. If you're thinking, for example, in this kind of effective halo model-like strategy, when we're kind of adding in this kind of semi-analytic models for what we expect a higher K, yes, it absolutely can be extended further. And that's something we're also interested in looking in. Beyond kind of K of one or so, we also need to think about effects of baryonic feedback. That's something we really need to turn to hydrodynamic simulations, but I think there's a student working on that at the moment. So that's something that we'll be interested in extending this model to in the future.
Okay, thank you.
This might be related to earlier questions that were asked as well, but the smoothing scale that you marginalize over in the effective halo model, it's not degenerate with like neutrino mass or something, which could have shape.
Yeah, so that would be certainly an interesting thing to look at. I think it's not something we've explored as yet. I think most of these simulations did not have neutrinos in them. We have shown that the power spectrum still works in massive neutrino cosmologies. I guess the question would be, if certainly at a perturbative level, the effects of neutrinos were simply a suppression of the whole power spectrum, or whether it only affected some of the perturbative terms. If in the latter, it would certainly be easy to separate them out. If in the former, then it might actually start to be an important thing that we need to be thinking about. But certainly physically, the kind of the physical motivation for introducing the smoothing was to say that the density field of, so effectively it comes about by saying that the halo density must depend on the underlying density field. And physically, it's not quite clear why this should just depend on the underlying density field at a point. It's more likely it would depend on the underlying density field in the local region, because kind of that's where halo formation is actually happening. So I think physically we do actually expect some of this smoothing. But yeah, that's an interesting thing to think about.
I have a question.
Sure.
In the application of effective field theory to particle physics, you have the UV and the low energy.
Yeah.
And you use a cutoff, because you don't know what's going on at the high UV.
Yeah.
However, as you go up, as you increase the size of the cutoff, the number of free parameters increases quite dramatically.
Yeah.
And this gets back to this question about the parameters. How do you avoid getting too many free parameters?
Yeah, so I think this is kind of a generic kind of problem with effective field theory and really any perturbative approaches, I guess analogously here, if we were trying to extend the validity of effective field theory, we'd want to go up to two loops. So to go up to kind of the next non-trivial perturbative order, and we do that, exactly the same. We have to add more and more free parameters. If you're looking at the matter power spectrum, that's the number of free parameters isn't huge. As soon as we add in bias traces, it starts to get much, much larger. And at this point, I don't think there's a good solution to that problem. And I think at the moment, that is a fundamental limitation of these theories, is more and more free parameters.
Yeah, there's no known solution for this in particle physics.
Okay, good. So I'm not alone.
So you're part of the business.
That's good.
So I had a comment, if you don't mind. I think one suggestion I have for, taking care of this, this non-physical Von Hello term and the small case is to use the compensated halos.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've seen, I guess, Alice Chen and I.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. Well,
Yeah, and I think it's just it seems like it's a much more physical way of basically doing what you just described, which is you form halos from cosmic collapse of the matter, but you don't actually change the total amount of matter.
Right.
So anyway, so that's just a suggestion if you're kind of going down this path. One way is
properly kind of dealing with these effects is something we're kind of doing at the moment. But I should definitely read more into that paper.
Good. Well, let me know if you are, if you want to talk about this.
Sure. Today. Absolutely. Thank you.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. To follow up on that, on this slide, you're showing the matter power spectra, right?
Yes. Yeah.
But we also use the Halo model, to model things like cross spectra.
Yeah.
So for the same parameters in the fits that you're showing here, do you also find similar levels of agreement between, things like the cross spectra between halos and matter, or the halo-halo cross spectra?
So I think we have not explicitly tried to do halo-matter or halo-halo spectra. For the main reasons being is that they start to include, to properly include in effective approaches requires a lot of free parameters. So like obviously just one linear bias parameters, but higher order, a lot of bias parameters.
So why are there more bias parameters for the cross spectrum than for the matter auto spectrum?
Okay, so what I say is the matter auto spectrum has the very nice feature that although there's kind of implicit bias parameters in the Halo model, they all integrate out to zero or one on very large scales, so they can actually be safely neglected. Basically, the idea is that on super large scales, your Halo model theory should match linear theory, which means there cannot be any dependence on bias or anything else like that. When we write down this Halo model, you really don't need to think about biases, or higher order biases at all. But in the cross spectrum statistic, those effects are important. So I think the other thing that motivated us to do this is that our original ideas had always been to apply this in the context of weak lensing as a first point, which obviously is the matter power spectrum, although obviously the cross spectra then would require more of these things to be explicitly thought about. That's true.
I actually wanted to second what Neil mentioned, that I don't really think there are extra parameters in the cross power spectrum, except that, the parameters would be the halos, of the halos that you're considering, because you're looking at the special halos when you're looking cross power spectrum.
Yeah, so I think all I mean is just the biases of those halos.
Of those halos, like that's fair.
B1, B2, of the specific halos you need.
Already part of your calculation though, right? Because the Halo model, has a prescription for things like, things like the mass profile for each halo
mass
for each halo mass spin.
However, what I will say is that for the matter halo model, you could include, say, a second order bias in your matter halo model, but you'll find it never contributes to the halo model. Simply because on large scales it has to disappear to zero. Simply because you can't depend on bias on large scales, just because you should be equaling your linear power spectrum. And on small scales, you're dominated by the one halo term. So any higher order biases do not contribute to the matter power spectrum in the Halo model.
Well, SPT, right?
Okay.
So we would, think of these higher order biases giving us something like a white noise contribution on large scales, right?
Well, to an extent. They would have a contribution to the power spectrum. For example, B2 would contribute a power spectrum convolved with itself. Now that contribution has to vanish at k equals zero, because otherwise we don't recover the linear power spectrum.
Yeah, okay. I guess I'm just wondering if your one halo, term via its fit is somehow absorbing these higher order biases.
That's a good question. I'm not explicitly sure about that. I can certainly say that You can force the one halo term to become zero at K0, and you can still fit perfectly well. Just only with an implicit linear bias, no other higher order biases in your matter. So.
All right. If it sounds like the questions are petering out, let's thank Oliver one more time for a great talk. And yes, and I'll see everyone later.